This is The Way We Connect, exploring the way we date, relate, and communicate. I'm Gwyneth Jones, or Gwen. Last episode, we spoke to Louise, who, despite having had a lot of relationships, was still determined that she was going to find the one. But what about people who don't find the one in their lives? What about people who don't care about finding the one? Some people are asexual or aromantic. Some people just don't care that much about finding a romantic or sexual partner to place any real importance on it. A lot of us grow up believing, you know, that's just what you do when you grow up. You find a partner, you get married, you have kids, you get a house together, and you stay together until old age. But now more and more people are questioning or rejecting that idea. A lot of people now that I know are choosing now not to have children, not to get married, not even necessarily to pursue a lifelong partner anymore. So when we talk about the way we connect, maybe some of us just don't. It's natural that most people crave human connection. Just because someone isn't searching for the one, or isn't searching specifically for a romantic or sexual relationship, doesn't mean that they don't want human connection in a variety of other ways. Some people are happy being in a romantic or sexual experience with one or more people, even though they don't have any designs on turning that into a lifelong sort of situation. Just because we don't seek lifelong pair bonding with somebody, of course, doesn't mean that we don't want to connect with other people. So moving away from this idea that there's one way of living life, you know, finding a partner, staying with a partner, feeling bad about yourself when things don't work out, we're going to look today at what life can be like if that isn't, you know, your blueprint for life. We're going to talk today to a couple of people who are not so convinced about the idea of soulmates, and we're going to explore what life can look like when you don't place that much importance on the idea of finding a romantic partner.
Not my man. So one of you had bad breath. Well, two of you, actually. And one of you had floppy hair. One of you looked a bit like Penfold, though Danger Mouse certainly wasn't there. And one of you had deep pools of darkness in your beautiful brown eyes and in your soul. I couldn't help you there, but no one can help a man who will not acknowledge the desires of his heart. And all of you were smart, sharp-witted too in some cases, and many races and differences abound. Among you all I sensed something I could learn from, something beautiful or soothing was found. And one of you had almost everything, but that building across the way tantalized you, tortured you in your work, made you feel you'd gone astray. And one of you was deeply hurting from your bid to choose for love. So you pushed me back and hurled your protests at me, and I couldn't do enough. And one of you still haunts me somewhat, because I couldn't put you down. Something about that sudden cut-off just puzzles me somehow. But none of you have found my soul. Perhaps you were too busy searching out your own. And searching is a good thing to do. I hope you find your home. I'm taking my own thoughts with me. My home is where I am. And none of you were meant for me. For you are not my man.
That was Not My Man by Rowan Bridler, author of Love Poems for People Who Don't Like Being in Love. Rowan's also an actor, singer, writer, poet, polyglot, and all-around awesome person. I met her when she lived in Prague, but at the moment she spends most of her time traveling between New York and London. Her poetry book moves through four stages of relationships, starting with lust, which is when they reel you in, then into when you're enjoying the lust and excitement, maybe even joy, then the third chapter, when they hold back, fail to deliver, and spit you out again, and four, when you have to let go, feel the loss, and pick up the pieces again. It's a very powerful collection of poetry, actually, and as I read it, I couldn't help but feel a bit disappointed at the lack of courtesy a lot of these men seem to have shown her, but I suppose a lot of women will really be able to relate to this book. So I spoke to Rowan, not just about her poems, but about her life and her attitude towards dating. Hi, Rowan.
What I'm wondering about today is this idea of finding the one. So in your experience, do you think that that's still a dream or belief that a lot of people still hold on to?
A lot of people do still hold on to it. I mean, I'm a little bit different in terms of I have no need of finding the one in a sense for the sake of having a family, because I don't want a family. So for me, that pressure is off. So I guess other people have to buy into it on the basis of, you know, you need some stability in order to bring up children, and therefore people need to sort of believe that there's a partner you can have that can be the one. But I guess the meaning behind that, though, has always been, you know, someone who's your soulmate, someone who you feel deeply connected to. And obviously, there's more to it than that. And it, even if you find someone who is a good partner, who you can feel is a good companion for you in your life, whether that's someone you can grow with to the same, at the same rate and to the same extent, is, you know, a big question. And for a lot of people, that doesn't happen. And you either at some point earlier on, or, you know, 10 years down the line, realize that maybe you're going in different directions, or there are things that feel like you've come to an end with them, and it's just time to move on. So I think it is something that is a myth, because people like things to be simple and straightforward. And I think life is more complex than that. Certainly in the culture in the UK and the US, other cultures have different attitudes to it, and other countries have different attitudes to it. Even from my time in the Czech Republic, I mean, the Czech Republic is a very proudly secular country. And so there's a sense of them like, well, you know, you hope for the best, and if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. Whereas I think there are other people in other cultures and countries would feel much more resolute that you believe that it's going to last for life, and that's what you're in it for. That's something that's just, it's inherent in the culture that you grow up with, but it hasn't been around forever, contrary to popular belief, perhaps.
Did you ever believe in this idea at any point in your life?
It's a really good question. I suppose I must have done at some point, but I think after you have that first relationship that breaks down, you realize, okay, yeah, this doesn't work, and people do grow up and change and do different things. And, you know, the first relationship I had went on for years, but it was very part-time. We didn't live together. In a way, that suited me rather well. So it's all about the kind of compromises you're willing to make. And I suppose, in a sense, the way of believing in something that could really work is whether you can find someone who really shares that sense of wanting to question everything, wanting to really communicate well as to what your values are in life, what your goals are in life. And if for 10 years or so you can have the same values and goals, great. You know, maybe not the one as only ever going to be one, but you can certainly have someone who's a soulmate or a good companion for that period of time. And there's nothing wrong about that. I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of or feel is a failure in having a relationship that lasts that long and was really good for most of that time. I don't think that feels like a failure, ultimately.
There's an interesting point here. And when I read the book The Ethical Slut, which is a book I recommend to anybody, not just people who are interested in polyamory or non-monogamy, as the book is talking about, but that society seems to judge anything other than lifelong pair bonding as a failure. Why is that? Why can't the ending of a relationship be seen as a beautiful thing if two people decide that they just don't want to be together again or anymore in that way? Why can't that evolve into a friendship or something different? Why do we have to see it as our mission to find one person who we're perfectly compatible with and then fight tooth and nail to keep that alive even years after it no longer works for either person involved?
It really does depend on the things that happen in your life that may be out of your control anyway, and the things that are your core values. So if one person has a core value that, you know, you want to be able to contribute to society and you want to be able to grow as a person, and the other person has a core value of let's try and make life as easy as possible, you might find some conflict that means that you're not going to stay together for very long.
Do you think as well that as our values change, as well, as generations, you know, we are becoming more focused on our own individual goals, how do you think that's affecting the whole idea of lifelong romantic partnerships?
That's really interesting. I mean, that's a big question. Obviously, there are a lot of changes that have gone through the generations technologically. And that seems to be very fast moving. So that has an impact on our lives more than we realize, I think, you know, even from the simple difference of, you know, not having mobile phones to having mobile phones, the idea that you can meet up with someone at the last minute and or rearrange at the last minute to be 20 minutes later, or all of those sorts of things have just really changed the way that people plan to meet up or spend time together or talk. So that has a huge impact on how people perceive what's available to them to do. That also varies according to demographic in terms of, you know, wealth, family background, all of those sorts of things. So yeah, I think it does have an impact the way that people feel now about their future and what they're able to do based on what you can see on social media or whatever. We aspire to different things. And I don't think that's a bad thing. But I think we also need to be realistic about what we're seeing and what we're aspiring to and whether that's based on something genuine. It really is a time that's forcing us to look at ourselves in terms of really being honest about our own priorities and our own values. Because if we're just trying to kind of copy what everyone else is doing because it seems like fun, we haven't gone back far enough to question ourselves about what we want to do and is fun important in the first place. And, you know, all of those sorts of questions that are much more fundamental. And I think we need to be really aware of the education that is happening for people growing up today in terms of, you know, how are they being educated to handle emotional difficulty? You know, are they acting on it with a sense of being open to trying to heal something if they've been hurt? I mean, we've got people in governments now who are clear examples of how hurt people hurt people. You know, I think there are things in culture that concern me in terms of this idea of trigger warnings or stuff where people are not willing to look at something that's really painful. And I think we have to be prepared to do that. I think we have to be prepared to go through difficult emotional times as well. We have to be aware that that's part of life and be strong enough as people to handle that and not shy away from it and not become victims and say, you know, someone's done this to me. We have to be able to question our own responsibility in something. And I think that's an important element. This sort of emotional intelligence is an important element of being able to manage relationships and manage our expectations around relationships accordingly.
I mean, do you think this is part of the problem that people find somebody that they like and they get all excited, and then when the difficult emotions start to pop up, which they inevitably do, they go, oh, well, obviously this person wasn't the one for me, on to the next one. Because we're not trained very well to handle difficult emotions, and because we see them as a problem rather than, you know, something to work on, we see it as something to avoid.
Definitely. I mean, absolutely. And I think it does come from that sort of not having questioned what you want in the first place. I mean, I remember having been on a couple of dates with a guy who's very, you know, doing very well in his career, let's put it that way. And we'd had some really good conversations, but it seemed like there was a vagueness and a kind of uncertainty from his side. And I at one point, what is it you do want? What are you, you know, what was the reason you're sort of looking, you're dating? What was the reason for going on these dating apps? What are you looking for? And he said, well, I don't really know. And I just thought, well, if you don't know, love, I can't help you. You know, I mean, really, if we haven't looked at what we're really looking for, who we are as a person, what works well and what doesn't, we've just skipped a big, really important step. So if a relationship is sort of starting out and it seems really exciting and then something becomes difficult about it, maybe it's just you feel disappointed by someone because they didn't do something you expected. Well, you have to look back at what were your expectations? What things do you want? And communicate those. If you haven't got that sort of emotional intelligence and sort of awareness of yourself in the first place, then you will encounter lots of difficulties because you're just like a little paper boat on the ocean or something. You know, you just haven't got enough stability to be able to manage all the highs and lows of everything. You know, people are complicated, you know, and there will be times in any even excellent relationship where you're really well matched, where both of you may be having a really tough time at the same time. And that's the most challenging thing. But you have to be able to know a few strategies for managing that so that you keep your, in a sense, it's a bit of a 12-step program thing to say, but you keep your side of the street clean. In other words, you take care of the things that you can control, the things that are your responsibility, and that includes your emotions and analyzing why they're coming up and what you can do about it. So that when you are spending time with that other person, you've dealt with yourself first. You're not coming in with an agenda of I need this from you or I will, you know, that's the sort of approach I think people need.
This idea that we need to apply our own oxygen mask first, God, that we need to work on ourselves, make ourselves perfectly happy and only then go out into the world and find love, is one that a lot of us struggle with. Partially it's because we're social creatures and we know or instinctively feel that other people can make us feel better. Of course, this is true. Loneliness is a big predictor of depression, and having strong social connections is one of the key indicators of happiness and longevity. So this idea of keeping our own side of the street clean can seem quite counterintuitive. How are we meant to be happy when we feel completely alone? But I think this comes down to the fact that we're seeking the majority of our emotional needs from one primary relationship. Instead of friends and family and, you know, a wide social network as we would have done in the past, we're now expecting this one partner to be everything for us, to fix us, to, you know, fill up our empty cup. It comes back to what we talked about in the friendship episode that, you know, in this day and age, friendships, adult friendships are really neglected. Part of this can be the social pressure to couple up and have children. You know, as you get older, more and more of your friends will inevitably start having children and they won't have time for you anymore. And it can really start to feel like, wow, everybody's moving on. Maybe, you know, maybe I'm a failure because I don't have a family yet. Maybe I'm weird because I don't want a family. But when your strong social connections start to disappear off into their, you know, family black holes, some people start to think, well, if I still want to have strong social connections in my life, my only choice is to have a family, is to have children. Do I have to do that too if I want to have strong social connections in my life? Well, the answer is, of course, no, you don't have to do that. More and more people are choosing not to have children now. And, you know, these people are not going to suddenly stop wanting social connections when they hit 35. They'll still want to have strong friends and social connections. And what I find is that, you know, among my group of friends, those who don't want to have children, don't want to have families, are really open to the idea of forming a stronger and stronger community, having closer and closer friendships. And so this idea that if we want to have strong love and connection in our life, that we have to find a romantic partner, you know, to be in a couple, that isn't really true.
I'm thinking too, a lot of people were, of course, pushed into marriage as a means of financial security, right? I mean, it still happens in a lot of the world now that, yeah, maybe a lot of people feel that they have to partner up with somebody not because they really want it or it would make them happy, but because, you know, they don't feel that they have many other choices.
Whatever situation you're in, you have to be able to communicate with your partner why you're going into something, because if they're going into it for a different reason that doesn't align with yours, then you're not helping each other out. I mean, think about it from a sort of friend's point of view. If you're just friends and you were just agreeing to get married because it's useful for some reason or other, then you would list out those reasons and say, look, here's what I plan, here's what I am expecting from you, here's what I don't expect from you, you know, tell me what you expect from me, let's see if we can make this work. And then once you have that in place, then at least have a basis from which to build. There's nothing wrong in deciding to get married for those reasons. If that's what's going to work for both of you and you're equally both getting what you want out of it, fine, you know, who am I to say that that's a problem?
In terms of choice and different types of lifestyle as well, it seems now to me that more and more people are choosing not to have children. So do you think there's still a pressure to, say, partner up and get with the one, even for people who, you know, come out and say, well, I don't want a family, I don't want to have kids?
I'm not sure that there really are more and more people who are choosing not to have children. I'm not sure about that. I haven't come across a lot of people who've decided not to have children, really clearly made that decision. Obviously, I mean, from my point of view, the way I see it, and that doesn't mean that anyone should see it the same way, there is no reason to get married other than if you were to bring up a family, other than perhaps, I don't know, for the fact that you can't both live in the same country or something. Mm. I am very concerned about the implications of marriage that seem to be detrimental to men when it comes to divorce law, and, you know, saying that women should automatically get 50% of the man's income, or the man, whatever, whether it's the income or the amount is based on the last year's pay or something like that. But I just don't understand that. If you don't have children, it's very different if you do, because if the woman is staying at home looking after the kids, then she's doing work that could not be done if the man were working full-time and trying to stay at home and look after the kids as well. It's just not possible. There are things that need to be looked at, and I think people should be able to stay in a partnership for as long as they want, and, you know, have whatever, you know, legal rights to each other's money if they were to die or something like that, but not have to get married. I think, you know, that's something that people have been able to do for years now, and that's a good thing. And I think in terms of being encouraged or pushed to have children, I mean, it's very, very common, but it's very common that women are asked about it and not men. You know, if you've got a guy who's got to the age of 45 or something and hasn't had kids, hardly anyone's saying, oh, do you want kids? But for a woman who's reached sort of even 39, 35 even, it's all sort of, oh, when are you going to have kids? And I think it's something that people just don't have enough role models for. That's the main problem. I think we're looking around trying to find role models for people who have decided not to have children and are really happy with their decision. And I think we need to hear more from those people about what they're doing with their lives. I think as couples decide to not have children, if they've reached that decision, then, you know, in a way, there needs to be some conversation that's happened about how they do want to grow as people. Because for many people, I suppose, often the reason for not having children is because they have great goals for their career that are really important to them, because they are, you know, part of work that they love and really believe in. And I think that's really important. And I think you can still have a role in terms of contributing to the next generation or whatever by being a mentor. There may be a sense that you decide, okay, I want to be able to further my career to an extent where I feel I really am an expert in what I do. And the way that I want to give back rather than having children is to, you know, offer mentorship, or, you know, be able to give talks in places where that might be inspiring to other people. But we definitely need to hear more from these people. You know, as far as I'm aware, Helen Mirren and her partner, they definitely made the decision not to have kids. You know, I want to be able to hear from these people.
Well, let's start here. What about you? What are you doing?
Well, I mean, I've finished the second book and I'm bringing that out this year. I'm also working on kind of next project, which I don't want to reveal too much about, but the next book I'm writing is really about this sort of in-between stage. I mean, as a woman in my early 40s now, it is something where I'm looking for role models of women that I can look up to and learn from, because there are certain things about getting older as a woman that people just don't really want to talk about, and menopause is one of them, and all of the things that come along with that. And, you know, it's sort of, that's the best thing I can do, is talk about how I'm handling things and the things that I'm battling with. The focus of this book is really going to be very much about the fact that it's an in-between stage. It feels like you're partly this and partly that. And I think there is a difficulty in figuring out how to be an inspiring, you know, really independent, strong woman going into your mid and late 40s, into your 50s, how you deal with that when society seems to have no other, you know, role for a woman to, other than to be sort of bringing up your kids at that point, kind of slowly disappearing, slowly becoming more invisible. And I think I'm going to be bucking that trend really by becoming more visible. And I've been so lucky that I've been able to travel back and forth between New York and London so much, spent some time in Paris as well. I mean, I just feel so grateful for having been able to become sort of so international, really. It's like I've got my own little community of people in different cities and different countries, and I love that. And I think that's something that if you are someone who's interested in different cultures, particularly if you're interested in different languages as well, and looking at different areas of creative work that according to country and culture and language, that's definitely the way forward, to remain independent in such a way that you can travel frequently and really learn from your experiences and really learn from, you know, picking out the best of one culture from one country and the best of the culture from another and putting that together. And, you know, that way you don't have to be beholden to the culture you grew up in entirely. And so I guess, you know, I've really sought to educate myself with my own little agenda, my own little schedule of lessons, almost from reading different books by different people from all walks of life and from different countries and in different languages. And I think, you know, that's what's always inspired me, that I don't need to be limited to any one culture, and I don't need to be limited even to one language. And I think that is a way forward that I want to just write about and remind people exists, because it is very easy to forget that, you know, there are other ways of looking at things, especially if you have a very strong family or community influence on your life. If you feel like you're being judged or criticized for the work that you do, then your circle is too small. You need to find people elsewhere.
I realized a while ago that all the things I was seeking in another partner were things I could give myself, you know, support, encouragement, doing fun things. Like all of those things are things that I could get from myself and not try to, you know, feel resentment when somebody else doesn't tick those boxes for me.
On the one hand, you know, it's important to say, you know, I can't expect anyone else to make me happy. It's not anyone else's responsibility to make me happy. On the other hand, a good relationship is one where the other person makes you happy. You know, obviously you need to be looking after yourself primarily and being able to, you know, analyze if you're unhappy, why you're unhappy, and do something about it is really important. But at the same time, if you're going to be spending time with someone, it does need to be someone who makes you happy, you know, someone who makes you laugh, or there has to be some element of it that feels maybe something that you can't entirely pinpoint. If you're going to be with someone romantically, then there needs to be some romance. And you can certainly have a little element of that in your friendships too. There's a Vanessa Kirby quote, put more romance into your friendships and more friendship into your romance. You know, it's important to try and keep a balance all the time of making sure there's some element of fun and delight and, you know, something that really lifts your heart, you know, both in your friendships and your relationship, your romantic relationship.
Well, I definitely don't want to go down the road of suggesting that we should be an island and not have love and fulfill all our own needs and not need anybody else, because I definitely love relationships and love and friendships and think, you know, it's very, very important for us to have good, strong relationships in our lives. I suppose, yeah, what I want to say more is that we go to people, you know, with the already full cup kind of thing, that we are happy within ourselves and we don't sort of expect people to, you know, fix us or give us something that we could give ourselves, that we go to them because we like being around them and, you know, we make each other happy, whether that's, yeah, a friend or a lover or, you know, some mix of the two. Like,
absolutely fundamental. You have to be able to look after yourself well first. It's no good sort of being a sort of flailing person. Sometimes we do need to go through those dark nights of the soul on our own, but you will come out the other end, you know. And then, yeah, you get to have some great relationships if you've really looked after yourself, because you're not then acting out because someone didn't do what you expected them to do, or because someone's disappointed you because they didn't get you the present that you were hoping for at Christmas or whatever, because you make sure that you brought yourself the present you most wanted. You know, it really is very simple. It becomes complicated when we take on board other people's attitudes about stuff. You know, the example of the buying a present for yourself, you know, if other people just think, oh, isn't that a bit sad that, you know, you're buying a present for yourself? In the same way that, you know, people might criticize myself for occasionally buying myself red roses because I love red roses. And, you know, oh, isn't it sad that a man didn't buy them for you? Really? Is it? I don't think so. You know, a rose is a rose. It doesn't matter who bought it. Obviously, it's a bonus if someone buys me some red roses. That would be lovely, whether it's from a friend or from my boyfriend. It doesn't really matter that much. And we need to kind of choose the things very carefully that do matter. And I think that's where you come back to sort of really questioning, what are your values in life? What do I want to get out of it? What am I in control of? What can I manage for myself? And what would be, you know, the minimum that I can have in place to then go out into the world and say, right, I've got this in place. Let's see what else I can find. But go out into the world with that attitude, you know, in the same way as you embark on a relationship, with that attitude of, this could be fun. Let's see where it goes. And, you know, not have any demands from it. There needs to be a sense of play about things. There needs to be a sense of lightheartedness about things, I think.
My next guest, Natalie, describes themselves as non-monogamous, non-binary, queer, demisexual, grey romantic, and relationship anarchist. A lot of labels, but hopefully you'll see what they mean as I go on. So Natalie has this amazing constellation of friends. And from what I can kind of understand, it seems that among this group of friends, there's a lot of different types of connection going on, sometimes romantic, sometimes sexual, sometimes platonic, but always that people are questioning the norms of typical relationships. And this is something that I never really had the words for until hearing these in the next interview.
Hi, my name is Natalie, and I've grown up in Canada for most of my life, but I'm currently living in Prague as of 9 months ago or so. Yeah, that's pretty much where I'm at.
Okay, so I'm looking at relationships, and especially at the moment, this whole idea of soulmates and finding the one and all of that stuff. So yeah, I'll start with the biggest question. What are your thoughts on that topic?
Well, first of all, I don't believe in soulmates in general, I guess, as the term is often understood. But if people want to, I've heard different definitions used. Like, some people say, yeah, we have maybe thousands of soulmates around the world, and it's just like people that we can connect really well with. And I'm cool with that concept. But the idea of just one single soulmate out of like 7 billion people seems a bit unrealistic, like, I don't know what the word is, but...
So what about the idea that we have thousands of soulmates then? What do you think that means, like, in practice?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it means different things to different people, but it could just mean people that, yeah, like, we connect really well with, and they could play some important part in our lives, but I don't think it's like a spiritual, like, we're meant to be together type of thing. It's just like people we happen to get along with really well.
Yeah, so it's a way to express a kind of compatibility or a bond, would you say?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so what about your own relationship history or situation? Have you ever had a time when you did believe, oh, there's one person out there?
So in the past, I've had, I would say, like, three official relationships altogether, and at least two of those I've really felt like I could be with that person for the rest of my life, like, not necessarily in a monogamous context, but just like I really felt like I connected with them. But I don't know, it still never felt like, you know, they were my soulmate. It's just like, oh, I'm really lucky to have found someone I get along with so well. But of course, like, you know, shit happens and it turns out, well, actually, you're not going to be with that person forever. So, you know, I'm much more realistic now. Like, I never believed in soulmates or like anything like that. But now I don't assume that people I get along with will be there forever. You know, it's...
Yeah, I've talked to people who, you know, had a lot of relationships, but they still hold on to this idea that there's one person out there for them, whereas other people seem to, you know, change their mind about the whole concept and be a bit more guarded, possibly. So, I don't know, what do you think makes the difference between these different reactions to our first relationships that don't go as we expected?
I mean, definitely the way we're raised kind of has a big factor, like, not just our family or something, but the media we watched growing up or the communities we were around. Like, if we were raised in a very, like, say, Catholic environment and you have one partner for life and you're not supposed to do anything with anyone before that, and like you see all your friends and relatives like go on that path, like maybe you think like, shit, I need to find that person, or I don't know, like
yeah, definitely. It's just the idea that there's one person for you, and possibly the idea does come from some, or maybe if you grow up watching Friends and Ross and Rachel's whole thing makes everybody think, oh, you know, everyone has that one person that they keep coming back to. You mentioned not in a monogamous context, so would you describe yourself as non-monogamous or?
Yep, so technically I've identified as non-monogamous for, what year are we in? For wow, for like almost 10 years now. But I have been in long-term monogamous relationships before that and after that. Before that was because I didn't know there was other options. But after that, it's, you know, for various reasons, like the person didn't want to have an open relationship or something. But yeah, anyway, I've done it all. But I would say definitely like now, as of the last 3 or 4 years, like I don't settle for monogamy at all. I wouldn't say polyamorous necessarily, because that has like certain definitions or like certain criteria or something, like being in multiple romantic relationships kind of as like a definition. And for me, I don't place romantic relationships over other types of relationships. Say I would just use non-monogamous, which is a blanket term to describe myself. So I consider like my friendships very, very important to me. And you know, sexual relationships are kind of their own thing as well. Yeah, it's very common for poly people to have like one primary partner and they're the person that they're kind of like a couple with, and then they have like side relationships or something. And that's, yeah, I wouldn't say that's like the way I approach things. I mean, if that happens, cool, but...
So you mentioned before the idea of relationship anarchy. Can you tell me more about what that is?
Generally, the idea is that you approach each connection with each individual person uniquely and according to what both people agree on or works for both people involved. This is referring to any sort of relationship, whether it's professional or romantic or platonic or anything else. For me, I first heard of the concept and it sounded a bit pretentious to me because I didn't know what it was all about, and it just sounded a bit like a buzzword. But actually, it really does seem to sort of stem from anarchist ideas, and it's a lot more, it puts a sort of political bend to how people approach relationships. And at least for me, that's exactly what it's all about. I don't like society and media telling me how I should be relating to people and what I'm allowed to do with what types of people and what types of relationships. So for me, I think relationships should only be defined by the people that are in them. So yeah, it's kind of like build your own relationship. And basically, it emphasizes the autonomy of each individual and that other people can't really tell us what to do or set rules for us on how to be unless we also explicitly agree to that. So it's great fun because it also sort of decentralizes the focus away from prioritizing, you know, romantic life partnerships and that kind of relationship as more important than the rest, and you really just define what's important to you. So for example, one thing that I absolutely love about relationship anarchy is that it doesn't prioritize romantic relationships by default. So for example, if someone's hosting an event and they say, yeah, you may bring your significant other, in relationship anarchy, that's not, first of all, there's not one significant other usually. And second of all, that does not automatically mean a sexual or romantic relationship. Third of all, the host themselves should actually be inviting that person individually.
there's no reason that any two people should be considered a unit. And that's the whole point. The whole point is that each person is an individual making their own decisions and deciding whether or not those agree with the other people involved. I just love this lifestyle so much. For me, it's a great fit. It ties into my politics, the way I approach my life outside of relationships, and it really allows me to connect with people on a deeper level, I feel, because I'm not bound to the expectations associated with, say, platonic relationships in society and the fact that they're supposed to be lesser than romantic relationships.
Yeah. Okay, so you said that sexual relationships are a different thing. So can you tell me, like, how do you categorize or separate these different realms, like friendship, romance, sex? Because I guess in the traditional idea of soulmates, all those things are in just one person.
Yep. So yeah, someone's like your best friend and your soulmate and your only lover and your like only romance. And yeah, that's very much not how I like to live my life personally. I mean, if that works for some people, great. All the power to you. Do what works for you. But yeah, for me, I would say I treat all the different, I have sort of like four different vectors, you could call it, of like human relationships, platonic, or like human attraction, like platonic, romantic, sexual, and spiritual for me. And like, those are all four very separate categories. Like they can overlap, obviously, but they can just exist as like only one or only two things, like in a person, for example. So I have a few committed friendships, which I consider like, you know, very strong platonic relationships. Like we're involved with each other's lives. We know what's going on. We talk almost every day in some case. Then I have people who like, I consider friends with benefits back home. I don't easily get romantically involved with people. That's just like how I roll. But I do have like someone I don't really talk to much anymore, but that like I had feelings for, and yeah, like we were never together or anything like that. So just like different things for different people, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So what do you mean by committed friendship?
For example, one of my committed friends, like we talk a lot online. I mean, they live in back home in Canada, so we don't see each other much in person, but we know what's going on in each other's lives. We support each other emotionally. Yeah, so I guess it could mean different things for different people, but for me, it's like the intentionality that myself and a friend have set to acknowledge that we want to be friends and we want to remain friends in the future and be involved in each other's lives. It's kind of like the intention behind it. And, you know, if I'm in town or if they're visiting Europe, like we're like the first person to know kind of thing. So it's like we're important to each other's lives, but we're not romantically involved or living together or building a life together or something like that. So, but I would say the defining feature for us is like, or for my committed friendships, is that we have the intention of being friends for a long time. And like, if that changes, we need to have like a conversation about it. It's not like, I feel like a lot of friends, you kind of just, they just exist and you don't really talk about the friendship. But I feel like, yeah, for these kinds of things, it's one of those things that you check in once in a while.
Yeah, I've ended up like this with a few of my close friends, in that anytime there's an issue where maybe one of us has upset the other, we meet, we're able to have very honest conversations about it, including about, you know, do we still want to stay friends? How's it going to look? Mm-hmm. Rather than, I guess, the wider circle of friends where, yeah, things either just fizzle out naturally and you don't feel close enough to say, hey, why haven't we spoken for this amount of time? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you said about the different like aspects, like spiritual and romantic and sexual and platonic. Mm-hmm. I guess typically with people who don't question the idea of monogamy or of finding one person, there isn't so much customization with different friendships and relationships. Do you think so? Like it might be, you're my friends, these are people I date, therefore potential, you know, life partners, and then there can be one night stands, but that's, about as like variable as I see it in like most people. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I've thought about this a lot too when I see stuff like, you know, people saying Tinder is ruining dating or something. Like when I hear claims like that, it's like, well, the only two options aren't like one night stands and like serious dating. You know, there are other options too. Like I said, you know, I have a lot of close friends, and some of them like have been sexual in the past or are sexual, you know, from time to time. And it's not like we're necessarily together or we're dating or something like that. But it's not like as casual as a one night stand, for example. Like there's a big in between range for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I have to ask, like, does it ever get weird between you and these friends? Like if one person maybe changes their mind about what they want in the friendship or relationship?
Mm-hmm. Surprisingly, not as often as you think. Just communication is key. You know, if we've been friends for a while and we feel comfortable with each other, we can be like, hey, like, want to try something sexual? And it might be really good, or it might just be like, okay, cool, let's not do that again.
like that was a bad idea. Never mind. Yeah.
But it has never, in my experience, ruined a friendship. Like, so to speak, I've heard a lot of people be afraid of that or something. But yeah, it's all about communication.
Yeah, I'm wondering what would make it weird usually. I suppose if people are going in with the idea of, oh, this might turn into a serious relationship, or, you know, we're almost conditioned to think like sex has to make things awkward. Whereas why not be able to say, okay, I wasn't really into that, but obviously, you know, I still want to be your friend. How do other people react to this kind of lifestyle? Have you had any, I don't know, prejudice or weird reactions at all?
Well, I don't walk around at work or in public being like, this is my sex life or something. But yeah, I don't often, sometimes, but not often at all, walk around like holding two people's hands or something like that either. So I haven't gotten much backlash, but definitely on social media, people, I guess they're confused or they have questions or they just say, oh, this is so not for me, like kind of the moral high ground approach, which fine, cool, whatever, it's not for you.
So I have to ask, you are in Prague now, and you said that a lot of this was back in Canada, right? These friends you have. So how has it been for you here in Prague since you moved here?
Well, actually, funny thing is, when I first moved here, I actually installed Tinder because I was like, I have to make friends somehow, but it just wasn't my thing. Like, I can't judge someone's like personality based off a Tinder profile, and I don't actually date. Like, I don't enjoy dating, and I don't enjoy meeting people one-on-one, so I just scrapped that. But yeah, my usual approach is just meet people in group settings or like go to events or meetups or something like that, and just get to know people, show up to things slowly over time. Like, it takes time to build like connections with people and community. So it's only been 9 months, and like I would expect at least a couple of years for that kind of thing to build. So things are on schedule. But yeah,
to my notes are on track.
But I'm not the kind of person that could just meet someone and like fall in love with them like right away, you know. It just doesn't happen.
We talked outside the interview about the idea of different constellations.
So maybe some people who have read polyamorous literature have heard of polycules, and that's like, it's like your group of relationship connections, I guess, in the poly world, like your partners, their partners, yeah, that kind of thing. I like the word constellation because it kind of goes beyond just partners, and it's like, it describes important relationships in general. Yeah, when I sometimes draw out like my 20 closest friends or something like that in like a nice little diagram, and it's kind of cool to see my constellation of friends, as I would put it. I don't know, that's all I really have to say about
that. Yeah, okay, cool. I've heard too about something like constellation counseling. So instead of like traditional couples therapy, you bring in the whole constellation. But there's a whole system for doing this kind of work, I believe. Yeah, I can tell you more about it later.
Oh, I didn't, yeah.
Yeah. It's a whole thing, apparently. So, imagine if you did meet someone and you fell in love and they said, I just want to have a monogamous relationship. How do you react?
It's a good question, because that did happen to me like 6 years ago now. And I mean, ultimately, we started off monogamous, and ultimately I was just kind of unhappy with that. And I pushed them to be more open and see other people. And it was just very clear that we had different stances on this issue. And like, ultimately, it wasn't the reason we broke up, but ultimately it was one of them. So I just think, you know, things might seem really perfect at the time and you really want to be with someone. But if at this point, if that person is completely closed to the idea of any sort of non-monogamy, then I just don't think we're compatible long term, unfortunately.
So what can life look like if we remove this idea that we have to find one person? If we can free ourselves from this need to seek out this one soulmate and to find somebody who's going to somehow be our emotional, spiritual, physical, mental, everything. That's a lot of pressure to put on one person. And to be honest, it's a lot of pressure for the other person to put on you as well. It's quite exhausting. Of course, it's not impossible to find every type of connection in one person, but I'm just asking, what could things look like if we're able to let go of some of the ideas we've been brought up with? And do we really imagine there's just one person out there in the whole world that is the right person for us? Or do we maybe think that there are a few potential soulmates out there for us? Or can soulmate just be a really nice way to describe someone with whom we really click and connect on a really deep level? Back to Rowan for a moment.
We don't put enough emphasis on finding good soulmates among our friends. You know, everything needs to be a balance. If you have a really good relationship with someone, that doesn't mean that you, you know, have one partner in life and then you don't need to see your friends. I mean, friends are really important too. Friendship is a beautiful thing, and I think we need to do a bit better at it, really. As I say, I don't know what it's like to be, you know, someone who's looking for a partner because they want to have a family. I don't know what that's like, and that does have a sort of an element of a deadline to it, and therefore there is more pressure. But there has to be a way of managing that in spite of that deadline, in such a way as to say, well, there are other options, there are other things I can consider, there are ways around this. And go into in terms of, even if you're looking for someone that you can settle down with for the next, you know, 15, 20 years or something as a primary goal, that doesn't mean that you can't appreciate people that you come across and have a great conversation with, and that's it. Or people that you get very close to and realize that for whatever reason, they haven't gone far enough along their journey of really looking after themselves well and getting to know themselves well. And so you're not well matched, and it can be really disappointing. And I know that, I mean, I've experienced that, and I can see myself getting pulled in by someone who I felt very close to, very drawn to, very much like we were soulmates in some way. And yet he was definitely someone who would rather be right than happy. He was someone who'd rather sort of look at all the things that are wrong in the world and, you know, keep looking for more evidence of it so that he can keep ranting about it. And I didn't see how that was really contributing to society or his own mental health. And I just felt that it was going to be something that would really just keep drawing me in for the sense of feeling drawn to him, but not actually be doing us any good. So I would just be so upset that he wasn't able to meet me where I'm at, you know, emotional intelligence wise. So yeah, I think it's really having to be aware that even if you ultimately are looking to find someone who can be a great partner, who can be a great companion, you can appreciate the other things that come along the way, and you can appreciate what you already have, and you can appreciate someone who might be a great companion but doesn't have certain elements of things that you're interested in or things that you love that actually you could get a lot from your friends about. You know, you don't want to be just stuck with one relationship that feeds absolutely everything. I think that would be incredibly dull, actually. I think you need to find the elements of your friendships that really feed you and inspire you with a particular area that really complements the range of relationships and friendships you have.
In the next episode, I'm going to interview a couple who've been together for 10 years and who describe themselves as the happiest couple in the world, just so we can have a bit of balance. And I ask, is compatibility something that we just find? Is it something that is naturally there, or is it something that we really have to work on? Join me next time on The Way We Connect. Thank you.